Anyway, thank you for coming. Just because we are a very small group, I would be really interested in knowing, now you know who I am, I would be interested in knowing who you are, and still in any gap, who is in the living science, or who is in the scene, or maybe the legal hands who are in the medical field, or who is somewhat, who is from the allied professional, it's working.
Yeah, I guess.
So, if you can find the stick.
It's long, but it's working.
So, that might be interesting. So, as I said, as you need to come to me from Canada, so I'm happy to be a new leader, although that's, oh no, that's not working case, that would be, let's see that my computer tells you
which one.
Change the slide with that for the lens. The lens. So it's slowly coming. What?
You can go on the screen, it's a picture.
Okay, well, I'm not drawing. Okay, so that's gonna open. This is. So if it doesn't, then I'm gonna continue anyway. So my presentation would be in the three parts. First, I'm gonna talk a little bit about secondly, I'm gonna talk a little bit about models of care for people that are could be adapted for people with multimobility, and then I'm gonna finish and conclude. Talking about interventions for people with multimobility based on some work that we've done in my country, in my team, actually. So when I first started talking about multimobility, I used the metaphor of the elephant in the room, because multimobility is a really important problem. The only thing that is missing that I don't know how to move the slides, but it seems to be working now. Okay, thank you. Okay, that's for the picture of my winter. So this button here,
I got here.
So my sponsor. So that was just to remind me that I'm a family physician, and I've been doing that job for 25 years now, and right at the beginning of my practice, I was very frustrated by those patients with multiple chronic conditions, for which I thought that we didn't have the tool to care very well for those patients. So that's the three parts of my patient presentation, and that's the other thing.
think that it's changing. So so I think we're putting words into the multi-mobility concept. So we're starting to study the multi-mobility, and I have to acknowledge the work that has been done by people in the Netherlands, particularly Marian van den Acker, very important paper that in the 90s related to the prevalence, first defining what mobility is, and the first paper on the prevalence of mobility that has been published. There was some work that had been done before that in Germany, but just small research. So I really want to acknowledge this important work done by Marian van den Acker. So, the thing that is interesting, and that's, and I think that the metaphor of the elephant in the room will no longer be relevant after that, is that we have seen an increased number of papers related to multi-mobility. And actually, you see on that curve that this is an exponential growth of paper starting around 2004. But still, the number, the absolute number of papers that have been published on the is very, very low as compared to any other medical subject in the medical literature. But still, we're progressing in the right direction. So, just to be clear about, a little clearer about the concept of multimobility. Multimobility is a patient-centered concept. So you consider the patient and you consider all the medical conditions at the same time. And you consider all the potential interaction between all the conditions that are happening at the same time. It could be interaction between diseases, it could be interaction between treatment and disease, and so on. As opposed to comorbidity, that is a concept that is more from the disease, single disease paradigm, where you have to focus on an index condition, as for example diabetes, and you consider the other condition as comorbidity. So those are two different concepts, but if you look in the literature, they're all very often use interchangeably. And particularly in the literature from the USA, they don't use the word comorbidity, they use comorbidity. There's also another lab with another term that you can hear very often, and this one is more related to the care of the patient, and this is complexity. So for family doctor, by example, caring for patient, if you ask them what kind of patient that you consider as a multimodal, most of the time they would describe a patient, a complex patient with a lot of chronic conditions. But the definition of multimobility that has been accepted in the literature is two or more chronic conditions. So there's an overlap between the two concepts, but I think this is important for to do that this distinction. One thing that is interesting is that you look at the prevalence of multimobility in the population. We've done a systematic review that has been published last year, where we put together all the publications on the prevalence of multimobility done at the population level. So most of those studies were obtained by surveying patients and asking if they have condition and counting the condition. What we found in that is that there's a close relationship between aging and the prevalence of multimobility. So the more you get older, the more you have the chances to have having multimobility. But what is very interesting is that this is not a concept that is reserved for elderly people, because it starts early in the course of life. So you see at the age of 40 that the prevalence increased rapidly to get the plateau at the age of 80. So that is true for the study that I've done at the population level, but this is also true for the population that have, for the studies that have been done at the practice level. And as you see, there's much variation between the studies, with very, very high prevalence in some studies and very low prevalence in other studies. And the reason is related to the method that is used for measuring mobility, and particularly the count of chronic conditions. So all those studies use a different number of chronic conditions. So if you target only 5 chronic conditions and establish your prevalence of mobility based on count of 2 or more conditions, you're going to end up with low prevalence. If you have an unlimited number of chronic diseases and your definition of mobility is still 2 chronic conditions or more, you're going to end up with very, very high prevalence. And that's what is shown in that graph. But the important thing, again, is the very quick increase after the age of 40. So mixed mobility is not something that is happening only with elderly people. And still we have this tension between the clinical definition of mixed mobility and the epidemiological definition of mixed mobility. We have to remember that the reason for an epidemiological definition is to have something to compare from one study to the other, from one setting to the other. But for the professional caring for people with mobility, the epidemiological definition is not very important. The thing that is important is the clinical definition of mobility, which is just if we, and I've tried to identify some studies that have that were interested in looking at the trend in mixed mobility over time, and this is really very, very difficult to see, but there's a small line just here that shows that the prevalence of 4 or more conditions has increased steadily from 1985 to 2005. This is a study from the Netherlands. So the prevalence of mental mobility is really increasing all the time. So sorry for the graph that is not really readable. But we've obtained the same result in some studies that have been done in Quebec. So in 2011, we've noticed a 15% increase using the same definition as a study that had been done in 2005. So 15% increase in the prevalence of mobility. So that's a huge problem. In my province, that would represent 2.7 million of people with mobility, with the adult people, not adult people. And one of the reasons for this increase in the prevalence of mental mobility is the increase in the prevalence of several chronic conditions. Classically, you see on that graph the increase in the prevalence of obesity in the United States from 1990 to 2006. And you see that the prevalence is pretty high in 2006 for obesity. Same thing with diabetes. And the list could be, we could add other diseases to that. So there are many reasons for explaining that. But the result is that there's more people with multiple chronic conditions. Interestingly, in a study that we are doing right now, a cohort study, we compare people with multimorbidity at the first data collection, and we looked at what happened over time to them. What we report here is that for about a little more than 50% of those patients, there's going to be some deterioration of their health status after only 2 years, just related to their multimorbidity. The thing that is interesting is that there's a 27% of patients that have improved their health status has improved, even though they have been comorbidities. The challenge that we have in primary care and in healthcare is to have more people that would improve instead of having people with deteriorating. And this is probably some of the reasons why we are having more an increased prevalence on the comorbidity. Lifestyle is certainly an important factor associated with many chronic diseases. So in this same cohort study that I've just talked about, we looked at the relationship between the unhealthy lifestyle factor, and I'm referring to cigarette smoking, alcohol consumption, consumption, physical activity, fruits and vegetable consumption, and at-risk body mass index. So if you have 0 to 1 unhealthy factor, you have a prevalence of motor mobility or a risk of motor mobility of 20%. But if you accumulate the unhealthy factor, the prevalence of motor mobility dramatically increases. So, well, this is not a causality study. This is just an observation. This is not an association. But I think that it sends a very strong message that we have to do something about lifestyle factors. Another factor that we looked at is the relationship between poverty and motor mobility. Data from the same study showing that, well, we built a wealth score that we call. It's based on four factors: education, income, employment, and perception of income insufficiency. So we all put together the result of those four variables, and the result of that is if you have an account of A, it means that you are better off. So you're happy in life, and you have the lowest prevalence of motor mobility. If you you have a score of 0, that means that you don't have much money, you're not well educated, you're unemployed, and you can make ends meet, then the prevalence in that particular study was 100%. So a strong impact of poverty on the prevalence of motor mobility. So motor mobility has been associated with many factor or outcome at the patient level. I'm not going to present the result of all those studies, but just to remind you that it's been associated with a lower quality of life, with complications of any health condition, with medical error. It's been associated with polypharmacy, and this is a very important problem. The difficulty in applying guidelines to those patients, and higher mortality, and trouble with coordinating care, and psychological distress. All those outcomes have been associated with motor mobility. If you look at the healthcare system, motor mobility has been associated with health services utilization. So the more you have, you accumulate condition, the more you utilize the healthcare system. So it's true for ER visits, for visit to the doctor, for avoidable hospitalization, which means condition that could have been treated in practices that have been treated in hospital. Readmission after an hospitalization is also more frequent, and the length of stay at the hospital when you're sick is higher. So all those factors are associated with motor mobility. So huge impact of motor mobility. So the key message here are that motor mobility is the rule in primary care, as we've seen in the study, and it is not limited to elderly people. And the consequences of the community are numerous and sometimes dramatic. Now I'm using that picture just to remind you that a lighthouse is a guide, and it is used for its power to guide you when you sailed on a bad sea, and I think I find that this image treated very well the model of care, and I'm going to review very quickly some models of care that have been in place for many years, and I'll go very quickly because the time is going. Here,
task assistant manager requires. Well, how about just saying that?
Okay, so the classical Wagner model, the chronic care model, that say that if you work with a quicker, proactive team with an informed, activated patient, then you produce, you have predictive interaction, and you're going to end up with better outcomes. And all those in the bubble. That are all the elements of the system that have to be in place. So this model is important. It doesn't show you how to care for patients. It's just a model that has been moved by our healthcare system to decide or to implement some change in our system. One of the models that I find very interesting for caring for people is the patient-centered care model that have been described by several teams in the world, and here are examples of two teams, one in Canada and one in UK, that came to the same conclusion that those elements of the model are very important for caring for the patient. So consider the patient as a whole person with all the biopsychosocial perspective and developing a relationship, a long-term relationship with the patient, or we can refer to also to a therapeutic alliance, sharing common ground, sharing power and responsibility, being able to negotiate with the patient, to agree upon the role for treating or for not treating a condition, and to consider the patient as a person, and also to focus not only on the disease, but also on the illness experience. All of those elements are important when you are caring for the patient. In the United States, they built on that patient-centered model to produce a more systemic version of that called the patient-centered medical home, where you have a focus on the whole person in a practice that is directed by physicians, that offer NS access to the population, where all the patients have their own physician, and where the care are coordinated and created. So this model is becoming very popular in the United States and is and actually in Canada as well. So we see variation of that model appearing in the literature. And we started to see some demonstration that this model could bring better, get better outcomes for patients. An inspiration of that model is, it's one of the results of the transformation of the healthcare system that we underwent in Ontario, Quebec, and Canada a few years ago. We built something called the Family Medicine Group. In Quebec, or the family health team in Ontario, where you have a rostered population, so every patient has to be registered to one doctor in particular. We have nurses working with physicians to deliver the services to those patients, and you have allied professionals that are also involved in the care of the patient. So this model is becoming popular, and it's slowly replacing the classical medical practice that were just doctors working together, or even solo practice where we have doctors working alone and delivering care for patients. But the key actors in any model of care that you can imagine is first the patient in the middle of them, and any model of care, I think that the electronic medical record is an asset to organize the care around the patient. And the physician, the nurses, the allied professional, and from time to time, the medical specialists that have to be consulted with them and deliver quality care. But if you look at the use of the nurse, and the percentage of people who said that the nurse was regularly involved in the management of a chronic condition, as you see here, in Canada and Australia are not performing very well with the use of nurses in the care of chronic condition, as opposed to UK, where they use the nurses more often. So we have a lot to do if we want to change something. So the message here is that we have various models of care that do exist, but have yet to be implemented to a large scale. In Quebec, we're just starting implementing the family medicine group. There's a lot to do to disseminate this new organization. And there is a growing interest for allied professionals in primary care. And this is probably an important development in the way. Now I'm introducing the intervention using that image because I think that's the building of this opera house was a big, big challenge, and it required a lot of thinking to imagine how this structure would be supported. And the result, after all that, is really a masterpiece. And that's what an intervention should be. So if you look at the literature about the intervention that have been published for people with low-tier mobility, the first observation is that there's only a few papers that have been published reporting data on intervention for mental mobility. So we only got 10 in that systematic review. And very briefly, what we got in terms of result is that most of the result that we observed that we got from those studies are mixed results. So sometime improvement, sometime no improvement, sometime the state just worsened. So the only improvement that was more constant, but it's a limited number of studies, is improvement in the medication use and adherence and improvement in prescribing. So that was from all the 10 studies that we found. So there's a lot of the opportunity to try to build new intervention and to test them in primary care. So the implication of that is no strong evidence to support any particular intervention yet. We need to consider socioeconomic factor and literacy when designing intervention. And there's room for participatory research and participatory approach where you get the idea from the people that will be enrolled in those interventions. The definition of the population to be included in intervention is an issue that has to be solved. I mean, the more you are clear on the population that you are including in the study, the more valid will be the result. The outcome that will be measured in those interventions are also very important to think about. And I'm thinking here about outcome related to physical functioning and quality of life, goal attainment, so goal that the patient will get from their specific from the specific intervention is also important to take into consideration, and also academic analysis are badly needed. So now I'm presenting those iconic symbol of Canada. So we recognize here the beaver.
The beaver is some sort of a big rat, so I don't like that much, that symbol.
And some people in Canada are trying to make that polar bear the national emblem, but I think that's the political reason behind that is that we are trying to, well, there's fight against the who own the Arctic. So I think that our politicians are more interested in having that kind of symbol. But anyway, that's just to introduce some Canadian studies.
And the one study that I want to talk a little more about is this study that we've done called the PREMAP study. It goes for evaluating the integration of chronic disease prevention and management that I will refer to as CDPM. Into primary health care.
So I'm going to go quickly in that, but I'm sure that you've heard how about those silo programs. So if you have diabetes, sometimes you're referred to a diabetes program. If you have cardiovascular disease, you are referred to a cardiovascular program. Asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, all the same. And so, those silo programs based on guidelines that have been that are implemented everywhere in all healthcare systems. And the aim of those programs are many, but they want to reduce and correct modifiable risk factors, to strengthen individual self-efficacy for chronic disease, to optimize functional autonomy and psychosocial balance and health, and to support self-management. So what we did, we got inspired by those programs in our region, but instead of having a silo approach, we integrated those services but by multiple professionals into the practices directly at the point of care, because we noticed that in those silo programs, there was a high number of patients that were referred by specialists, because those programs were running in the hospital, was really hospital-based program. And even though the referral from the primary care physician or primary care practices could be, were welcomed, we observed that there was not much reference from primary care practices. So we really wanted to offer the services of CDPM directly in the practice. So the objective of the study was to integrate and evaluate CDPM services at the point of care and primary care practices. And we had four main conditions we were targeting in that program. So diabetes, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma, cardiovascular disease, and their risk factor. But we were also open in receiving people with other conditions than those that were mandatory for being part of the study. I just want to bring your attention that there was no mental diagnosis that were included to that, and it was against our will, because we couldn't have the funding for that part that was funded by another program. So we just build around that. But this is something that the practices told us that they would have been interested in being able to integrate also services, mental health services. So the evaluation that we done was to measure the effectiveness of the intervention among primary care patients and to assess the implementation of the CDPM program. So we were interested in knowing exactly what's going on. The design was a pragmatic randomized control trial and a reality evaluation. So I'm going to go quickly to it's very difficult to describe the intervention, because it was an intervention that was individualized for each patient. That was the base of our pragmatic trial. So, but there were general principles that we used to build that intervention. So the intervention has to be patient-centered. It has to rely on self-management support,
motivational interviewing, and of course it was integrated into the practices, and it was based on interprofessional collaboration. So all those elements were part of the intervention, and the allied professionals that were included in that study was respiratory therapists, nutritionists, physical activity therapists, and nurses. And the role of the nurse was very, very important at the beginning, because the referral would come from the practice, from the provider, and the nurse would be the first person to receive the patient and to agree upon to look at the reason why they were referred and to agree with the patient, negotiate a care plan with the patient. So the role of the nurse was very, very important. So that's where it all starts. The doctor just referring the patient to the team that was led by the nurse in the primary care practice. For a given patient, say with one profile, say that he is suffering from diabetes and COPD, he could receive a different intervention depending on the need of that particular patient. So the intervention could be based on education on disease, counseling and medication for what given patient, and for the other patient with exactly the same profile, that could be an education on nutrition or education on physical activity. So really the intervention was different for every patient that were recruited in that study. Just very quickly, did what you expect to do in any controlled trial. So we randomized the patient that were referred and that accepted to be part of this evaluation. We randomized them into two groups. One group receiving the intervention right at the beginning, just after the referral, and one group waiting for 3 months before receiving the intervention. And we did measure those patients after 3 months within a 3 month interval of time. So very quickly, just to show you that the group were similar at the beginning regarding the demographic of those patients, but there was some difference regarding the diagnosis and the burden of disease of those patients. So we acknowledge that. So randomization doesn't do perfectly all the time. So we took that into consideration and in our analysis. So that we can correct with that. Just to show you, even though we were not focusing on patients being with morbid, actually we were sure that the patient that would be referred would be in majority with morbid. And that's what we observed. Only one patient were referred, and they had only one condition. The majority had two or more, even three or more chronic conditions. So patients were very sick. So we used the health education impact questionnaire to measure the outcome. That was the main outcome. So this instrument has been developed here in Australia. And it has several domains, all related to empowerment and self-management. So I'm not going to go through all those dimensions, but just to tell you that this is a very good instrument and very adapted to that kind of intervention. And the result that we got from that, so you see here the two groups that are compared in very, very, very pale on that graph. You have the group that we call the control group, the group that received the delayed intervention. So no intervention was done in that group at the moment where we measured them. And in the darker green, that's the group with the intervention. So the thing that is interesting to observe is that even in the control group, there was much improvement. So up to 20% of the patient in certain dimension had a substantial change, a substantial improvement. This is an interesting observation.
what it tells us is that the minute that you are referred to the program, even if you are on a waiting list, you accept to receive the program, you start changing right away. So this is a good thing. And if you look at the result in the intervention group then, you see that for 5 out of the 8 domains, we observe a significant improvement as compared to the control group, which is very good. Same thing if you look at another outcomes that we use, the health status measured by the SF-12, we observe an improvement, and we were surprised because the 3 months period of time is very, very short, but we did observe a significant improvement in the health status of the patient in the intervention group as opposed to the patient in the control group. We even observed some improvement related to their consumption of fruit and vegetables, as you see here in blue for the intervention group, and for physical activity that also improved in the group that received the intervention as compared to the control, where we observed some deterioration in physical activity. So, and if you look at the qualitative result that we observed, that we obtained at the same time, people were very satisfied about the intervention they received. There was a wish that there would be more disciplines involved, and particularly mental health professionals would have been a good addition to that. It's really a need for the practices to have those people working. So this is something that we retain. The people would have been interested is more being more inclusive in terms of chronic conditions, so that we can offer the services to more chronic conditions, and also more time devoted to the intervention, because our intervention was a package of around 5 hours over a 3 month period of time, which is not much as compared with the silent program in my region that are around something like 20 hours. People were also interested in having follow-up visits after a certain period of time for sustainability, for being sure that the change will continue over time. And something that has been expressed that we wish that we could do a better transition with the primary care provider, because we thought that since the intervention was integrated with the primary care, that would be automatic, that the follow-up would be done by the primary care provider. But we understood by these comments, that we have to do something better on that issue. So the thing that is interesting is that we observe a relative substantial change in the control group, as I said before, but a marked improvement in the intervention group. We had, and I haven't shown the result of that, but we observed better results for people with multiple mobility for many outcomes that we measure. So when you have a patient, when you're treating a patient with multiple chronic conditions, there is something that could be done and that could improve their lives. So that's very, very an interesting result. And the long-term sustainability of the program, actually in terms of improvement for the patient, is something that we don't know yet, but we are looking at that right at this moment. So the final key message is that the integration of allied professional and primary care practices is a promising intervention, and that patients with multi mobility may benefit from this intervention. So I really, we're very happy with those results, and I've been invited to a meeting with the Ministry of Health in our province a few weeks ago, where our Ministry of Health made the announcement that part of this this reform of primary care with the family medicine groups, that they would add allied professionals into practices in the next years.
So we don't know exactly if this study has had an impact on the decision, but we're very happy that they're doing that because we made a demonstration that it could improve the care of the patient.
So I just want to tell you that this is not the only study that we're doing. So we are part of a big team grant called PACE and Multimobility. It goes for patient-centered innovation for persons with multimobility. So this is a $2.5 million program for 5 years of research. And I know this is a busy slide. I shouldn't present that, but I just want to tell you that what we're going to do in a few words, what we're doing is what we're trying to identify all those chronic disease prevention and management programs in Quebec and Ontario. We want to make an inventory of all those programs because there are many of them, they're all different, and we want to look at the result that we have. And we know that many of those programs are running without being evaluated. We're going to focus on those programs that are evaluated, and we put them into the synthesis, a realist synthesis, to identify what are the reasons for the successes and the failure of those programs. And we're going to try to improve them. With one program in Quebec and one program in Ontario, what we're going to do is we're going to work with them. We're going to develop a partnership with them. We're going to transform those programs. We're going to try to convince them to be patient-centered and to have a focus on multiple chronic conditions at the same time. So we're going to bring the SILO program, if they are interested in participating. And we're going to measure the effect of that with using the same, approximately the same framework as we use in the study. And the second, and the last phase of this program is we're going to try to do some scaling up of those innovation, meaning that we're going to work with many other programs and many other regions in Canada to try to implement that kind of activity that will be more responsive to the needs of people with disabilities. So we're going to be very busy in the next 5 years doing that research.
So in summary, multimobility is the rule in primary care, and the consequences are numerous. Various patient-centered models of care do exist but have yet to be implemented to a larger scale, and the integration of allied professional in primary care practices is a promising intervention, especially for multimobility patients.
So that was my final word. And just here
to show you the people I'm working with. So some are researchers, some are staff, research agent, and I'm very happy to work with all those brilliant people in my region in the Quebec province. So I'm open to any comments.